Welcome to Mid-Century Modernism with Monique, your go-to podcast for all things architecture, design, and innovation within mid-century modernism. Join me on a journey through the golden age of design, where every episode brings you fresh inspiration for modern living and unlocks the secrets of this iconic and timeless style. What are we waiting for? Let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. I am Monique Anton, your host, and I am so happy to have Rob Keel on the show today. Hello, Rob.
Hello, Monique. Glad to be here.
I've always been inspired by Rob. He is a friend and was a past client and the author of two amazing books that we're going to get into, Little Boxes, The Architecture of a Classic Mid-Century Suburb, and Art Fitzpatrick and Van Kaufman, who were masters of the art of automobile advertising. And these books have been so visually appealing and so exciting and so fun to read that I wanted to kind of dive in here, Rob, and talk with us a little bit about these books and how you got interested in these topics.
Yeah, well, first with the Westlake book, Little Boxes, I had grown up in a house in Pacifica and noticed a sign on the wall that said, you know, built by Henry Dolger Incorporated. And there was this kind of mythology around Henry Dolger and who, you know, and I of course wondered, who is this? And I even started to really get into architecture, you know, as a fairly young person, almost like pre-teenager, and started measuring the house and kind of figuring out how architecture works. And a number of times when I was younger, my parents would bring our family over to Joseph Westlake, which was for fancy dinners, you know, fancy in quotes. We'd go to Joseph Westlake and we'd drive through this other neighborhood that looked a lot like ours, but it was even more fun and more interesting and kind of quirkier. And I discovered that Henry Dolger had not only built, you know, my neighborhood in Pacifica, but he had built the Westlake neighborhood in Daly City, which was that look that I kind of fell in love with and thought was just so cool. Upon further discovery, it was like, okay, wow, he also built thousands of houses in the Sunset District in San Francisco and was a major, in fact, the largest home builder during a period in the 1940s. So Henry Dolger had a huge history prior to my even realizing who he was. And then the opportunity to kind of focus on his self-identified sort of masterpiece development, Westlake, was a chance that I couldn't pass up once, you know, once I had moved there, that my wife and I moved there. And it was like, it was inevitable, of course, that we would move there because I loved it. And then getting into the house, it was like, wow, I really have to kind of dig into this. And it was funny, there was actually a moment when we were doing a little remodeling project and I had to pull back some sheetrock and I found a little cigarette, you know, carton or like a, you know, like a package of cigarettes that somebody had left behind the wall back in 1956 when the house was built. And you could even smell the tobacco on it. And there was something about just pulling this artifact out of the wall and realizing there were guys here and there was a purpose and there's a story behind this house that I was just like, okay, I've really got to get into this.
Yeah.
It's kind of like stepping back in time for a moment and realizing there was a whole story about how this neighborhood came to be. And just sort of the general realization that, you know, despite the suburbs getting a bad rap in many ways, that there was a history to suburban development. And particularly this, you know, this specific San Francisco suburban development was worth looking at and thinking about and kind of digging into. And I just found the story more and more fascinating as I met more and more people who had worked on the development and personally was able to interview them. It just started to become this thing where I couldn't help myself. And it was just so fascinating to discover, you know, facts about something that most people would never even consider to be worthy of study. It just became like this really interesting topic for me that kind of intersects nicely with post-war America, San Francisco history, mid-century modern design, architecture. I mean, all these subjects that I was kind of interested in just sort of coalesced into this book project. And I was lucky that, you know, I was able to do it.
Yeah. And Dolger, and you did it very well, Dolger built about 11,000 homes in the Bay Area, the same amount as one of our other favorite developers, Joseph Eichler. How was Dolger different than Eichler, and how were his subdivisions different?
Yeah, I think they are very different. I think they occupied a similar place in sort of post-war development history, but their purposes and I think their missions were very different. Eichler, I see personally as the person who brought high-end mid-century architecture to the masses. I think, you know, he basically brought like a Frank Lloyd Wright or Mies van der Rohe sensibility to a large audience. And he was absolutely, you know, obsessed with bringing that high art of architecture to a large group. And I think we can agree, you know, that no one did that better than he did. Dolger's job, and I think the mission that he took on with Westlake specifically, was how to build an affordable, high-quality mid-century suburb, how to provide the best kind of complete community and lifestyle possible for a truly mass audience. You know, the people that he was selling to were almost always first-time home buyers. A lot of them had just gotten out of service in the military in World War II. They were not high-end buyers. They were not even particularly style-conscious buyers. But by figuring out a way to make really well-built houses inexpensively and how to provide enough design variety and enough amenities that Westlake would clearly stand out from what was available in San Francisco and what was available farther down the peninsula in more expensive areas, occupied his unique kind of space that he worked in, bringing good design to the masses at an affordable price in a complete community context. And I think that's what Dolger is all about, the complete community context, as opposed to focusing specifically on architecture, you know, residential architecture as his focus, you know, as Eichler did.
Mm. I learned, after I discovered the book, I became obsessed, just like you are. And I was so interested in these homes that I actually contacted you. And from there, I found out that you were doing a documentary film. For those of you listening, you can watch the film on YouTube. It's called Little Boxes. Rob had done such an amazing, thorough job on this film. And it was, with all of your other work, yeah, I think you became just in a place where you couldn't finish it at the time. Yeah. And I just thought, this has to come out this week. We have to finish this film.
I'd worked on it for, I don't know, 3 years or so. And, you know, I even made a calculation once, like, okay, I've been working on it for 3 years and I have about 30 minutes.
Yes,
so if I want to finish it to be about 50 minutes, that's another 2 years of evenings, weekends, and vacations. I'm like, okay, this is just, you know, it just got to be too big of a thing. And it really was a kind of a one-man show up until that point, until you were able to kind of, you know, get the last third of it finished, which I'm eternally grateful for, because it probably would never have gotten finished had it not been for you. And Andrew, who did so much work on it. So yes, it was great that we hooked up for that, and then of course ended up working together on both a buying and a selling of a home, and you know just being friends and stuff everywhere, you know, after that. So I'm very grateful to have met you that way and to be able to kind of keep on just doing cool stuff with you. So.
That's amazing. Well, it was an honor to work with you. You and Espy were so great to work with. And this book and the film, really, I mean, Rob has done such an amazing job. It really was inspiring to me, your dedication to the community and for, you know, sharing this complete story. It's really great. So again, you can buy both books on Amazon, and then we do have a link on, we just put it on YouTube, so you can watch that for free. It's also on our website at modernhomesrealty.com. But going back to Henry Dolger, I learned through doing this film that he was a master developer. He even had things like someone was cutting lumber on site.
Yeah.
And what other production, tricks did he have like that? How was he mass producing?
Yeah, part of his strategy, like I said, in order to make this affordable for as many people as possible, was to try to figure out a way to make good quality homes in an inexpensive way. So he actually had a guy who went up north and bought redwood trees, that would just buy large numbers of redwood trees and have them shipped down to Daly City, to the location that is now where the Boulevard Cafe is on John Daly Boulevard, right off 280. That location used to be the Dolger Lumber Mill. And there would be giant redwood trees unloaded there, and he would make all of his own lumber. He had a complete lumber mill there. So, you know, instead of going to a lumber wholesaler who had already gone through the process of creating millions of board feet of lumber and, of course, marking it up and making a profit, he figured out a way to avoid that markup and make his own material. And he also figured out ways of pre-cutting as much lumber as possible and bundling these various floor plans into, like, essentially a truck full of components. So it's like, okay, we need to build a plan 14. All right, that consists of these 73 items. And they would cut all the lumber, wow, load it onto a lumber carrier, and bring it out to the location. And the foundation was already completed. They would have it all basically kind of ordered and set up. And they would build the house, you know, very quickly as a result of having lumber essentially pre-cut and ready to get nailed into place, instead of doing cutting on the location. Another thing he did was the various vehicles that he owned. A lot of them were World War II surplus vehicles that he had bought from the United States government. So he got a great deal on all this very expensive equipment by buying it used from the U.S. government. It's like, okay, the war is over and the government had to get rid of all these. He even bought like troop transports and trucks and all this surplus, wow, military stuff. And, you know, adapted it for use and for his own use as a residential developer. And, you know,
so smart.
Yeah. I mean, he was just a really, I unfortunately was too young to have met him during his lifetime, but I do know, you know, his children and have many people who work with him. And they all say he was just a brilliant guy and a very, mm-hmm, you know, a brilliant, hardworking, clever guy,
yes,
who was very determined to fulfill his mission of making affordable, high-quality housing for a lot of people. And I think he clearly did that, not only with the production process, but even in the design of the homes. Like, for example, using standard 8-foot ceilings, which allowed, you know, a use of a 4x8 sheet of sheetrock without having to go higher and, you know, make a second row. Use of split-level floor plans, which created this sense of staggered space that seemed bigger than, you know, a standard two-story house. You know, using pieces that were left over from the cutting of one house's lumber to bring those back to the lumber mill and reuse those pieces and cut them into smaller pieces. And that becomes something like a window frame or, you know, like a handle for a banister.
Wow.
So he used all the lumber. There was almost like no waste. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was so ahead of his time because in a way, he was kind of thinking economically and ecologically before, way before it was even considered to, right, be a good business practice. So, I mean, he was just an absolutely brilliant user of resources, you know, both physical, mm-hmm, and labor resources. He figured out a sequence of how to build the houses with the right crews, you know, how many people needed to be on a crew, you know, what their functions were, how long it would take to build, you know, a certain section. They would even time things down to the minute of how long it took to build this section of a house. Wow. And he would expect that they could continue that on other houses. I talked to a guy named Frank Clark, who was one of their construction foremen, and he told me that they were very intense about that. They were very intense about studying the process itself in order to find efficiencies and bring those efficiencies to the subsequent homes that were being built. So he just got better and better at it, and just smarter, wow, and smarter over time. So,
and I got the sense also through the film, through some of the interviews, the team was having a great time working for him. And I think he was such a great man. He gave someone a home, you mentioned, in the development.
He did many things, you know, for people. Mm-hmm. I should say, you know, not because I knew him personally, but because I know many people who knew him. He was one of those people that when he entered the room, you kind of just knew he was there. He wasn't obnoxious, but, you know, like some people just kind of have this magnetism about them. He was one of those people that when he walked into the room, you just kind of knew he was there. He was a presence. He was gregarious. He was, you know, he was friendly. He was kind of inherently optimistic. He was brilliant, but he was not at all, he wasn't, you know, an exclusive sort of guy. He wasn't, you know, he didn't have any kind of pretense about him, even though he became a wealthy man. He came from very modest means and had spent most of his childhood in poverty, and he never lost that sense of identity of just sort of being a regular guy, despite mm-hmm. him becoming extremely popular and successful later. So, yeah, I mean, he made working fun for the people that worked for him. They worked mm-hmm. hard, for sure. I mean, mm-hmm. they were very productive. But there was just kind of this sense of teamwork and this sense of fun and discovery and just sort of a sense of humor about him that really appealed to people.
I remember in one interview, one of the designers said that they had submitted a split-level design as a joke.
Yeah.
And Henry yeah. ended up loving it.
Yeah, yeah, that was...
Love that.
That was Ed Hegeman, who was kind of the primary building designer for the first few sections of Westlake. And that's the house that's on the cover of the book, what he calls the fish and chips house. He wanted to kind of go a little wacky and was just playing around with different designs. And of course, you know, he said that he put it into the stack as a joke, and Henry loved it. And he said, well, you can't build that. I just threw it in there as a joke. He said, no, we should build this. And he did. It ended up being kind of one of the most, you know, perhaps the most sort of iconic Dolger-built Westlake house. But he had a sense of humor. And also, I think it's interesting that he did have a love for mid-century modernism, because if you look at Dolger's own house, it's a very modern-looking building that looks like it could have been, you know, in Los Angeles in the late 50s. I mean, it was built in 1953, but it is clearly of the mid-century kind of clean, modern look that he clearly liked personally. So, you know, even though he built many different styles of homes within Westlake, Dolger's own sensibilities were very modern. And it's interesting to see that come through in his own house. And also his brother, who lived literally next door, John Dolger, lived next door to him. And the house on the other side, I think, was another one of his close associates that built a very similar, very, very 50s-looking, modern-esque house. So he had that love of modernism, clearly, and wanted to bring a certain amount of fun and whimsy and kind of, you know, sophisticated yet also not taking itself too seriously kind of modernism. A friend of mine calls it pop modernism, and I think that's a good term for it, because it's modernism, but it's not a very pared down kind of modernism that's sort of exclusive. It's more of a fun sort of jaunty modernism.
Yes.
That has a sense of almost like a sense of bounciness or a sense of humor to it, almost, you know.
Yes. How would you put those pop modern, I love this phrase, pop modern with Googie? Would you put those together?
I think so. You know, I mean, when you look at, for example, the roof lines of the fish and chips house, or the roof lines of many of his other houses, he had these double roof line models. He had also commercial architecture, almost all of which was built by Dolger's company in the Westlake Shopping Center, bowling alley. You know, I mean, there was a whole range of different little motifs that he used that were, you know, I would say kind of wacky, that definitely had that same kind of Arme and Davis sort of look to them that you saw in, for example, the Lion's Restaurant. And they actually built a Lion's Restaurant in the in Westlake at the top of the hill there, which I believe, I'm not totally sure, that Dolger's company actually built that particular Lion's location, even though it was an Arme and Davis design. He, I believe, executed the actual construction. So he clearly had a love for that kind of sort of fun modernism that, again, I guess doesn't take itself too seriously. You know, the sloping roof lines, the big expanses of glass, you know, just the playfulness of, you know, repeating a shape or repeating a window pattern that just doesn't take itself too seriously, you know.
Mm.
it's just kind of, they're kind of fun and they're kind of friendly in a way that, you know, that say a Mies van der Rohe building might not be considered friendly. It's definitely, it's modernism with a touch of whimsy.
Mm-hmm. I've had, since the film came out, I've had a lot of people write in, and you've been on these emails with me. They say, Westlake was amazing for us, and we are so thankful that Rob did this book and film. And people have kept these homes in the, you know, different generations. And it's so important to them what you've done. So that's just wonderful to see these, and to have you on the show talking about them is really wonderful for me too. Moving on to the other book that you did, which I just recently bought. And for those of you out there that are car fanatics, this book has so many amazing classic cars in it. And I wanted to know how you got into, you know, this part of mid-century modernism also.
Yeah, you know, when I was a kid, it's another childhood story. When I was a kid, my dad had a collection of National Geographic magazines down in our basement, in our Henry Dolger house, by the way, of course. And for whatever reason, one day I started sort of thumbing through them. And I didn't care much about the articles, but all the ads in the old National Geographics were actually in the front of the magazine and in the back, so you could find all the ads and miss the rest of the magazine. And I just got to flipping through ads from various time periods. He had them going back to the 1920s or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I just started flipping through these magazines one day that he had been collecting rather diligently for years. And I was like, oh, look at this cool old car. And oh, look at this ad for Kodak when they introduced this, or, you know, the original Polaroid camera, you know, the SX70, or, you know, old Coca-Cola ads from the 40s and things like that. I just got kind of fascinated with mid-century era advertising in particular. But for me, like, the absolute pinnacle of that was car advertising, and at the top of that was Pontiac car advertising. And as I became more interested in mid-century advertising, I noticed that the initials AF and VK were inscribed into these paintings that were in these old Pontiac ads. And I was very taken aback by them. And, you know, as a sort of young budding artist, I tried to draw many of them myself, and I still have many of these old drawings I made when I was 10 of these Pontiacs. I was trying to reproduce what they had done, making these beautiful renderings of these cars, mainly from the 1960s. And it stuck with me. I became an art director in advertising, I think, possibly primarily because of that kind of influence of seeing those ads and seeing these gorgeous illustrations and the kind of sophisticated lifestyle that they were portraying in the ad campaign. Well, I became an art director in advertising, and one day while I was at my office, I decided to look up AFVK. So I went on Google and looked up AFVK Pontiac, hoping to figure out what or who AFVK was. Well, it turns out AF was Art Fitzpatrick and VK was Van Kaufman. And Art Fitzpatrick was still alive and around, and he was about 90 years old. Van Kaufman had died in the 1990s, but Art Fitzpatrick was still around and was offering prints of his paintings that he had done in the 60s for Pontiac and other automakers. So I ordered a print, and I sent him a letter. I said, hey, you know, Mr. Fitzpatrick, I'm a longtime fan of your work, and in fact, I'm probably in my career because of you, and I'd love it if you could, you know, sign my print and mail it back. And so he did that and sent me a very nice letter saying that he was glad to hear from me and hoped that he hadn't sent me off in a bad direction in my career by convincing him that advertising was a good idea. And, you know, so anyway, he had a good sense of humor and was very friendly in the way that he wrote back. So we continued to kind of correspond a bit and become friends over a period of time. And, you know, I said eventually, I said, hey, Fitz, and he wanted to be called Fitz, by the way. He never would be called Mr. Fitzpatrick. It was far, far too formal for him. So I said, you know, Fitz, somebody really needs to do a retrospective of your work with Van Kaufman, because it's you know, it's clearly, you know, the gold standard of car advertising illustration. And, you know, nobody's done a book, nobody's done a film, nobody's done anything about this, really. Except in other books, or covered in a small way, and, you know, an overview. But somebody's really got to do a book on you. And he's like, yeah, well, you know, somebody's, there's been talk of it. And he mentioned that other people had either started it or tried it or whatever, but it had never gotten completed. So he and I kind of decided first that we would do it as a kind of a documentary film, that I would interview him, kind of get his life story and cut it into a show that would be maybe a 45-minute show, very similar to the Westlake documentary, sort of that, you know, less than an hour kind of film. And we went quite a ways down that path, and I got some tremendous interview footage with him and started to cut it together. But we could just never agree on, you know, the length of it, how much cars, how much Fitz would be in it, how much other people would be in it, the mix of historical and personal. We just could never agree on how it would coalesce as a documentary. Mm. And then I said, well, you know, we could still do this book, and I think we should do a book. And he said, and he agreed to it. He said, yeah, let's do it as a book. And he gave me a whole bunch of, you know, scans of his artwork and a whole bunch of documentation that he had kept throughout his career on doing this work, and told me, okay, Rob, go ahead, get started. And so I did, and I worked on the book for maybe a year, year and a half. Then I became a dad, and I needed to take some time off to really enjoy being a dad. Mm. And a couple years later, Fitz died, but I was able to continue the project with cooperation with his wife and also Van Kaufman's family. Chris Kaufman, Van's son, was very helpful in moving the project forward and getting me material and having stories and things to kind of, you know, do a book that was really a biographical sort of portrait of these two men, but that was really at its core an art book showing the techniques and the end result paintings of their work together. You know, so that was how I really got into it. It was really a childhood sort of fascination that turned into a friendship that turned into a book eventually. And, you know, that was my way to sort of honor my friend, but also to, you know, document a period in advertising that I think was really the pinnacle of both kind of sophistication and artistic craftsmanship that I think was, you know, later lost in the 70s and 80s when photography took over. You know, I think car advertising did lose some of its magic that it had, you know, in the 50s and 60s where illustration was dominant. Mm-hmm. And this book is my attempt to showcase that beautiful work, but also to, you know, do a portrait of Fitz and Van and to kind of preserve their techniques of how they made the art, which is something I found really fascinating to find out how they did it, which was always, to me, kind of this behind the curtain mystery, you know, like the Wizard of Oz, you get to pull back the curtain, like, okay, Fitz, how did you do that? How did you make this reflection? Or how did you make the pictures look so realistic? Or how did you distort the cars to make them look glamorous? I had spent hours and hours with him kind of discussing these specific techniques that he'd used and developed over time. So I was able to, you know, not only make a book that showcased a very strong collection, a couple hundred of pieces of artwork that Fitzpatrick and Kaufman collaborated on through the years, but it was also my chance to, again, document this process of doing these paintings that, you know, nobody does those anymore. You know,
right.
That's a lost art of doing, you know, pencil sketches of cars followed by, you know, paintings of cars for ads, because we've now turned to photography or digital imagery now, you know, and I thought it was important to also preserve kind of that, the craft that the illustration was in that time period.
Absolutely. I think this is so important to preserve this information and these things, because they are our history, they are our culture. And if you had not have done this, it would have been lost information, which I think is so sad. One of the things that we as modernists really, really dedicate so much time and effort to is preservation of the homes, of this information. I think it's wonderful that you did that, and it really is a beautiful showcase. So,
well, thanks.
That's amazing.
I think in both cases, with both books, I always felt like I was frankly surprised that there was not a book about Westlake, that there was not a book about Art Fitzpatrick. Both of which I think are major kind of beacons of mid-century design in one way or another. And frankly, it just ended up me doing the book because it didn't exist, you know?
Right.
It's almost like there should be a book, and if I have to do it, I will.
Yes,
and I did.
Right.
I really think there is a kind of, you know, there is a need for certain things to be preserved and appreciated. And sometimes we have to personally step in and do it if it's not been done already.
Yes, you know? I love that.
You've done that in many ways with your work in, you know, in the real estate business and in architecture as well, with preserving you know, the documentation of the Eichler look and the floor plans and even moving forward with new buildings mm-hmm. based on the original designs. I mean, I think you've also done a lot of that in your own work where you are able to kind of look at these things that existed in the past, make them, you know, document them, preserve them, and even move them forward in a way that, you know, would not otherwise be done. So mm. yeah, I think we can both agree that there is important work there, you know,
yes.
that needs to be done. And if I can help facilitate that by doing these books, I'm happy to do it.
That's wonderful. Yeah, it's very important, I think, being a voice to show people, hey, you know, these homes aren't teardowns, for example,
or Absolutely.
Here's what you can do to preserve them has been really amazing. And just giving someone an option to do that because they have, you know, they don't know otherwise has been pretty amazing. And, you know, you and I share this sort of a mission mm-hmm. to do that out of respect for what we see and what we've gathered so much joy from. This house that we purchased here that we're sitting in right now, everyone thought was a teardown. We've restored it. We can't imagine living in anything else. Your home, which is a beautiful stone sin, some people would say, oh, these are older, so what do you do with them?
Yeah, you knock them down, you build something else. But yeah, I mean, I find that ironic because, you know, you think about, I mean, I think sometimes it just takes putting something out on display and having people look at it, you know, just making people aware of the existence of something and where it came from and the artistic wherewithal that it took to make that thing. I think both with architecture, with illustration, industrial design, you know, I mean, I think just having a look at those things and realizing the thought and care and sort of mental fortitude that it took to make something like that is just really worth looking at and evaluating and appreciating. You know, I think it tends to be that things that are more common that we see every day, we tend to not pay attention to because they're so ubiquitous.
Commonplace, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. People would think, oh, there's thousands and thousands of those houses. You know, they're no big deal. But no, just, you know, look at it for a moment. Think about it for a moment. Realize the care, the precision, the artistry involved in building an Eichler-style house or a Dolger house or,
yes.
or, you know, anything like that, that combination, you know, that sort of mid-century combination of elegance and fun that I think is sort of maybe the hallmark of mid-century design, a combination of, you know, sophistication and quirkiness that is just so special, you know, that's worth paying attention to and worth preserving. So, you know, it's fun to be able to help in that in some way or another.
Absolutely. Well, on that note, for those of you that have films that you want to finish or books you want to finish or information that you think is valuable to someone, it is very valuable to someone out there. So do the research, find out who to contact, and make it happen. Thank you so much, Rob, for being on the show.
Thanks. It's been really fun.
We'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique. Thanks for tuning in to today's episode. I hope you had as much fun learning about the world of mid-century modernism as I did. You can also catch the show on my YouTube channel, where we walk through some of the most stylish mid-century modern homes in California. Just search for Mid-Century Modernism with Monique and hit subscribe. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave me a comment to let me know what you think. Your feedback helps me make the show even better. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time on Mid-Century Modernism with Monique.